Songbird, insurrectionary, continuity and escalation on the fronts of border regime, by Lee Secuda, read to you by the author. Dykes, bitches, harpies, sluts, every street is flooded with them, overflowing. They fall down from trees as walnuts, burdensome with vicious promise. Thunk, 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 crash. They gush out from stinking gutters. They radiate out from the beams of streetlights. Everywhere there are women, their voices, their faces, their hands, their teeth, their livers. Their intestines are lashing out from under porch steps with venomous fangs. Women's screams condense the air into fog, and the fog obscures the terrain. Everything that seemed transparent to power is rendered relentlessly opaque. No industry or agency can clear them away. No adequate form of containment can be imagined. Women laugh down the barrel of one gun, 2, 100, and then 3,000. When one falls from a blast, 100,000 more women fly from houses, from the muddy earth, from snowdrifts gritty with salt and oil. Suppressed spirits released from the realms men assumed to hold them as fast as death. There is no armament impressive enough to keep them from laughing, from screaming, from wailing and wailing and wailing. Every agent is drowned in a cacophony, washed away in a flood of spit and mucus, piss and shit, blood and derision, chased down and destroyed by frost and by fire and by song, too. Regime has escalated its ethnic cleansing campaign. This campaign is not new, nor is it an aberration from the values and cultural practices that preceded it, but it is a notable and undeniable escalation that calls for analysis, agitation, and resistance on every front. This is a campaign to remove people of color from social life, to extract value from them through a prison industrial complex revitalized by the ever-profitable distinctions between citizen and non-citizen. The definition of citizen has always been malleable and, in the United States, carries an implicit whiteness which has made denying, revoking citizenship status exceptionally useful in efforts to mass incarcerate, maim, enslave, and ethnically cleanse racially marginalized people. It is a profitable system of devaluation and has been since its invention in slavery. To be subjected to its machinery is to be rendered disposable, reduced to raw material for production, consumption. Powerful men are enriching themselves even further by pushing more people out of center, out of borders, into precarity, into an ever-expanding margin. They are not inventing these methods from whole cloth. Just as other fascist regimes before them, they are utilizing structures that long predate either Trump administration to facilitate a radicalization process which, if allowed to continue, will conclude in another genocide. Our context is in continuity with the past. Before this regime came to power, undocumented people were hounded by border enforcement, kidnapped from their communities, tortured in concentration camps, trafficked to other countries, and murdered on public streets. Before this regime, mass incarceration was already status quo. Before this regime, people were shot by local cops and federal agents alike on false pretext. The United States is a project that began on the inheritance of thousands of years of patriarchy and authoritarianism, and was founded upon and maintained by the genocide of indigenous people, the enslavement of black people, and a racial caste system that establishes white people at the top of a global hierarchy, with propertied white men resting languidly at its uppermost pinnacle. Recognition of that history and how it shapes the conditions we fight today, that the state of things are in continuity and active relationship with the past, is paramount. Our context is also an escalation from previous conditions. To acknowledge and understand the contours of that escalation appears just as vital. The machine is speeding up, heating up, billowing green smoke, launching tear gas canister after tear gas canister. It's emitting a high-pitched whine that the previous engineers took at least some pains to keep quiet. It's practically screeching, steaming, obscuring the extent of its own functions, more and more its malfunctions, to prioritize a fearsome performance. Its new operators think this is marvelous. This is, after all, why they started out by firing the engineers and all the other buzzkills. After destroying the perceived effeminacy of the cooling system, they've got big plans, to cut out the brakes. This is how they signify that the machine is finally being run by real men. Real men stop for nothing. We can trace both the influence of continuity and an emergent pattern of escalation from the arrests of pro-Palestinian protesters early in 2025 to the near indiscriminate harassment and kidnapping of people of color off the streets by the closing of the same year. Here is a process of a regime radicalizing. The ground prepared for them by the suppression of campus protests and thousands of pro-Palestinian activists under the Biden administration. The second Trump administration practiced with black and brown students and professors who agitated against genocide and the interests of their greatest vassal state, Israel. Mahmoud Khalil, Rumeyesa Ozturk, and Barar Khansouri were all documented and had no previous criminal charges before they were captured by border enforcement agents. To defend their kidnapping and incarceration, the regime invoked the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952 to argue that the state could deport any immigrant, documented or not, if their presence is deemed to have serious negative consequences for U.S. foreign policy. This is notable not because this was the first time border enforcement has been leveraged to disappear organizers and suppress dissent. Far from it. But this was an early moment in which this fascist regime flexed and tested its capacity to redraw the boundaries of citizenship. It was also an unveiling of the tactical aesthetic for its agents that would appeal to the forces of hierarchical reaction from which regime would frantically have to pull material and physical support to accomplish its goals. Masked men decked out in military tactical gear springing from unmarked vehicles to kidnap people of color off public streets. This essay is an endeavor to connect many of the fascist escalations we face today to their historical lineage and, in doing so, uplift a corresponding continuity with the resistance of the past. The means of repression are not new, even if some of their forms may be novel, and neither are the most successful tactics in resisting enforcement. Though their use is undeniably expanding, the strategies deployed by ICE watchers have long been used by communities of color, women and children of color in particular, to protect themselves from state incursion. Indeed, while this piece will explore a variety of current and historical conditions, its core concern is racially marginalized women and children, the means of suppression leveraged against them and the shape of their resistance to it, and it is to them it will relentlessly return. Patriarchy is a primary recruitment tool for border enforcement agents, and gendered violence against their victims is ritual. Women and children's vulnerability to border enforcement and the impacts of its operations on them are not incidental, but intentional, and have a wider scope than is made visible. It is because of this that I locate them as the inventors, developers, and most skilled practitioners of the insurgent tactics used to disrupt campaigns of ethnic cleansing of the past and present. It is because of this, I argue, that the insurgent front is and always has been filled with women and children screaming. Repression. Let's begin by surveying the most recent escalations in the regime's ethnic cleansing campaign. Border enforcement operations have ramped up nationwide and have been leveraged by the regime to undermine the political power of states with populations that resist its fascist projects. With the 3,000 agents deployed to Minnesota in Operation Metro Surge serving as a prime example. At time of writing in March of 2026, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has captured and detained for deportation approximately 73,000 people, an 84% increase in its detained population in 1 year alone, and the most people detained by the agency on record. 32 people died in ICE custody in 2025, the most recorded in 1 year since the first year of the agency's operation, and at least 13 more deaths in detention have been recorded in 2026 thus far. The records of those killed by Customs and Border Protection, CBP, are significantly more difficult to attain by design, and even this inadequate and sabotaged data reveals the agency as the deadliest among federal law enforcement. Government officials suggest that at least 21 victims died in CBP custody in 2025 alone, and data gathered by the Southern Border Communities Coalition records at least 29 fatal encounters with CBP in 2025, including, but not limited to, those who died in their detention. While the violence is occurring with higher visibility and rapidity under the current regime, all of these cruelties and more were perpetrated by state enforcement agencies well before the Trump administration took power. 11 people died while incarcerated by ICE in the last year of the Biden administration. DHS has been responsible for the incarceration and displacement of millions in its 23 years of existence, and 12 of those years, a majority, were under Democratic leadership. The total number of deaths directly caused by DHS's border enforcement operations and its detainment apparatus since its founding is unknowable because their agencies have many strategies of underreporting, including the common practice of releasing dying people so they don't have to put their deaths on record. Further, the violence of arrest, the inherent stress of incarceration, the prolonged abuses in detention, the physical process of deportation, and its isolating final result are debilitating to the extreme and inflict long-term mental and physical damage on its victims that are rarely measured, certainly never by the DHS, for whom deaths out of reach of record is point and purpose. This intent is demonstrated, too, in the deadliest and most bipartisan border enforcement policy, prevention through deterrence, that has killed approximately 80,000 people attempting to cross the southern border in the last 30 years of its implementation. Impact goes wider than those who have been captured or killed by agents, wider even than the many thousands pushed intentionally to their deaths by border infrastructure. Migrant workplaces are among the primary targets of federal raids and serve a double purpose of kidnapping key producers in migrant communities and keeping those they don't capture from making life-sustaining income, which cause a cascade of effects that push them into even more precarity and vulnerability to border enforcement. Local economies grind to a halt, and the affected can no longer afford food, medical care, or housing. Further, when people are taken, incarcerated, and trafficked to other countries, the roles they played in their communities and interpersonal relationships are left empty. Many of DHS's victims act as the primary or even sole caretakers of vulnerable loved ones. When they are kidnapped, children are left neglected, are lost, are pushed into the foster care system. Disabled people are abandoned without the support they need to survive, and their conditions deteriorate under stress and neglect. Ophelia Torres, only 16 years old, had her cancer treatments disrupted when her father, Ruben Torres, was kidnapped by border enforcement in Chicago on October 18th of 2025. In her online appeal, Ophelia said her father, quote, has been the main parent who watches my brother while I stayed at the hospital, and implored the public to remember that, quote, immigrants are humans with families and deserve to be treated with love and respect. In the following months, while debilitated by the later stages of an aggressive cancer, she acted as a fierce advocate for her father and others taken by federal agents. She was present at his hearings, including the one that occurred only 3 days before she died on February 13th of 2026. The life and death of Ophelia Torres and others like her who are killed by the actions of border enforcement will never make it into the official state record. The greater burden of stress is deleterious yet plausibly deniable impacts on health, and the legal process's incompatibility with the demands of the medical industrial complex are mechanisms of the ethnic cleansing campaign as surely as kidnappings, deportations, and direct killings are. Perceived excesses of the regime cannot be blamed on a lack of training or slackened hiring processes. Jesus Okora and Raimundo Gutierrez, the two CBP agents who killed Alex Preti, have been employed by the agency since 2018 and 2014, respectively. Jonathan Ross, the man who murdered Renee Good, served as a machine gunner in a combat patrol in Iraq from 2004 to 2005, then as a CBP field intelligence agent from 2007 until he joined ICE as a deportation officer in 2015. He trained other agents as well in his role as a firearms instructor. Far from the image of the confused, inexperienced, untrained agent that many liberals are blaming for the extremes of border enforcement violence, he is the exact kind of man that agent training is designed to produce, and more agents than Ross have used his tactics to murder people without consequence. There are numerous cases of Border Patrol agents intentionally and unnecessarily stepping in front of moving cars to justify using deadly force against vehicle occupants. Agents on the southern border have been shooting rock-throwing teenagers to death when simply moving out of range would be trivial for decades. The recruitment posters of the past dared men to become part of the legend. Those of our time ask, want to deport illegals with your absolute boys? Then, as now, there are men gleeful to answer the call. Dogs on the whistle. They were begging to be given the chance, and they glory in it. When one man among them decides that a person is an insult to his authority, he can body that insult with violence and know that every man with him will back him up in his escalation, clap for him when his gun is still smoking. His own clenched fist magnified fivefold by men as power-hungry, as entitled, as willing to act on it as he is. It's what patriarchy always promised him. He is finally home. To each other, they chuckle. They cheer. They say, it's like Call of Duty, right? So cool, huh? That is, to each other, they say, it's a game. A man's dream finally come true. The trappings of power with little personal risk. What these men were only able to inflict on their tiny fiefdoms of the home, on the women they pursue, on the families they control, they can now play out on a massive scale with brothers in arms, on cities full of non-player characters available to torment and destroy, in concentration camps that render those they capture into more easily exploitable resources, and through all of this earn the esteem of their brothers, the honor of their commanders, a game token, a pat on the back, a bigger and flashier gun. Border Patrol in the United States traces much of its lineage to the 1823 founding of the Texas Rangers, an organization created foremost as a means to violently suppress indigenous peoples, enable white slaveholders to colonize the land in service of an exploding cotton industry, and eventually to wrest control over the territory now known as Texas from Mexico. They fought in the service of the earliest formations of the ethnic cleansing campaign that the state agents of today work to further industrialize, and were instrumental in the time period of U.S. history referred to by its survivors as La Matanza and the Hora de Sangre, when thousands of ethnic Mexicans were lynched and massacred in Texas between 1910 and 1920 to redefine citizenship and establish the foundations of the militarized southern border we contend with now. Describing the Texas Rangers massacre of 15 unarmed boys and men of El Porvenir in 1918, a woman who bore witness said, quote, they had questioned no one at all, and their first words were threats. Tejanos in the borderlands were killed regardless of their citizenship status and retroactively labeled bandits or bandit sympathizers to excuse and further embolden their murderers. In this lineage, too, is Texan Governor James E. Ferguson ordering Captain Ransom of the Texas Rangers to, quote, go down there and clean it up if he had to kill every damn man connected with it, with the added reassurance, quote, I have the pardoning power and we will stand by those men. Evidently, neither CBP nor ICE nor any of their operations under the present regime are deviations from the lineage of border enforcement and the construct of citizenship in the United States history. However, it is insufficient to critique these agencies in isolation and without naming the enemy in all forms of policing. The first official report from Berkeley Cop Watch in April of 1990 could easily pass for a description of border enforcement operations in 2026. Quote, they wear no identification badges and no numbers. Although they cruise in an unmarked car, they are not trying to hide the fact that they are police officers. They are, however, attempting to remain anonymous and therefore unaccountable. This is very dangerous, and all citizens should be worried about Berkeley's secret police. Every extreme of violence perpetrated by a border enforcement agent has a predecessor in police force, an institution older than the modern border, with white supremacy and anti-blackness in particular serving as its foundation. In 2016, Philando Castile was in his car with his girlfriend and child and posed no threat to the cops who stopped him, but still he was shot to death on the streets of a Minneapolis suburb and his killer was acquitted of all charges. In 2020, Derek Chauvin of the Minneapolis Police Department knelt on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes in front of a grocery store until he was dead, murdering him in daylight and in front of bystanders who recorded and begged officers to relent. Regardless of which administration is in power, police in the United States kill over 1,000 people every single year and incarcerate over 5 million. Over 6,000 people die behind jail and prison bars annually. The lineage of police violence can be traced back into the earliest history of slavery in this country and sourced in the role of the slave catcher. From there, it can be followed to the anti-black massacres and ethnic cleansing campaigns like those that were inflicted on the black people of Memphis in 1866, Atlanta in 1906, and Tulsa in 1921. Just as the Border Patrol has done since its founding, police have recruited their officers from the ranks of white supremacist groups like the KKK. Just as Border Patrol has done since its founding, police act as occupying military forces to enforce and defend the structures of white citizenship. It appears misleading to refer to policing and border enforcement as separate and distinct phenomena, when material reality demonstrates such a great deal of collaboration and overlap. Look to the 1930s, to the forced removal of over 1 million ethnic Mexicans from the United States. This white supremacist mass movement of the Great Depression involved the enthusiastic coordination of federal, state, and local officials, comparable to that seen today in the extensive joint operation, dubbed Operation Tidal Wave, by officials taking place in Florida. Of that era was the 1931 raid of Los Angeles's La Placita Park, when LAPD, in collaboration with border enforcement agents, blocked the park exits and detained the over 400 people there to be interrogated about their citizenship status. If this story seems familiar, it might be because of the October 2025 raid on La Catedral horse racing track in rural Idaho. The details are eerily similar. In a joint operation between local, state, and federal law enforcement, exits from the track were blocked and over 400 people were detained and interrogated about their citizenship status. Police involvement, then as now, is what makes many border enforcement operations possible. The 287G program, which saw a 950% increase in participating police agencies in the first year of the Trump administration, makes the police's de facto deputization as border enforcement agents official and streamlined. More escalation within historical continuity. We cannot stop short, as many do, of discussing patriarchy and violence against women, an undeniable unifying force among state agents and their most empowered enablers in society. An overwhelming majority of those employed by the DHS are men, and the gender disparity is even higher among CBP and Border Patrol agents, men making up 81% and 94% of agency personnel, respectively. This is not an error to be reformed away, but instead a representation of men's political investment that must not be ignored. It is to men's affinity with authoritarian power and their desire to do violence in its defense that state enforcement agencies of all kinds appeal in their recruitment materials. Brotherhood and brutality and total protection from reprisal is the essence of what agents are offered for membership. Regardless of the gender of individual agents or victims, border enforcement agents are being recruited to do gendered violence, and gender is present in every act of violence they commit. Under their power, all of their victims are gender marginalized, and every gender marginalization is taken to its extreme. They use any means to deny the manhood of the men they capture, to remove its symbols and protections, and thus mark them as targets for sexual violence. To the already gender marginalized, in every attack, violation, and privation by border enforcement is the message that under patriarchal rule, woman, whatever else it may be, is an assignment to disposability, to the subhuman, from which they will never be allowed to escape. Before CBP agent Charles Exum rammed Marimar Martinez's car and shot her 5 times in October of 2025, body cam footage revealed one of the agents saying, quote, "Do something, bitch," while readying his firearm. In a signal message afterwards, Exum told his buddies, quote, "I fired 5 rounds and she had 7 holes. Put that in your book, boys." Jonathan Ross murdered Renee Good after both she and her gender nonconforming wife demonstrated how little they respected his power, to such a degree they were willing to mock it to his face. As Good died, her car speeding into a crash, "Fucking bitch" is spit after her. Within days, and in the same city, Aleah Rahman, a disabled woman of color on her way to a medical appointment, was dragged violently from her car and detained by federal agents for the crime of becoming trapped in a ruthless double bind. Quote, her only options were to move her car forward in the direction of ICE officers and risk being accused of trying to harm them, which led to Renee Good's death, or stay stationary, which in the end led to physical violence and abuse. Alex Preddy, a white man, was murdered by CBP agents after he had the audacity to act in solidarity with the women the agents were assaulting instead of seeing his interests aligned with the men wielding authoritarian power. In attacks by federal agents and within their custody, especially so in concentration camps, women are subjected to racial and misogynistic slurs and sexual assault. Agent after agent asks, threatens, quote, have you not learned your lesson when we killed that lesbian bitch? Bitch, 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 a staccato from lips cracked bloody by the Minneapolis winter, unraveling like a machine gun firing, bitch, 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 bitch. The history of border enforcement's violence against women is sparsely documented and underexamined. Women's marginalization in the labor force and within the institution of the family, along with their connection to community and presence in public space, has made border enforcement operations against them look, at times, different than operations against men. Importantly, border enforcement's operations against men cannot be meaningfully separated from their efforts to displace women. Patriarchy makes women economically dependent on their relationships with men, and it is that vulnerability agents of white supremacy have long exploited. The phrase, quote, you don't buy from the husband, you buy from the widow, was popular among white Texans during the decade of La Matanza, referring to the practice of executing Tejanos to coerce their wives into selling their property. This practice has changed form, but maintained its essence through history and to the present day. Formal border enforcement operations with a focus on detaining laboring men is a means to cut women and children, efficiently forced into precarity and dependence by patriarchy, off from many of the resources that make their lives possible. Sexual violence against all of their victims has been routine for all of border enforcement's history, and against the gender marginalized, it is made ritual. Women's contact with state agents has always been characterized by sexual violation, and its constancy as a threat has loomed over every encounter. An example of this in the historical record can be found in the 1910s, when the United States government erected the world's first gas chambers using Zyklon B, one of the many U.S. projects from which Nazis took inspiration. While utilizing racist propaganda that framed Mexican migrants as dirty and carriers of disease, the U.S. set up delousing plants at border entry points. At these plants, migrants were stripped naked and searched for lice, and if any were found, they were forcibly shaved. Their clothes were steamed and drenched in chemicals, and the people themselves were gathered together, still naked, and sprayed down with a mixture of soap, water, kerosene oil, and Zyklon B. On top of these horrific and dangerous indignities was an additional sexual violation for women, whose naked bodies border enforcement agents routinely photographed and posted on the wall of their local bar in El Paso. The imminence of border enforcement violence also increases their victims' vulnerability to domestic and sexual violence in interpersonal life, from which it ensures there are fewer means of escape. Abusers are well aware of the constant threat that their undocumented victims live under, and use the threat of reporting to border agents to keep them entrapped. This precarity is so extensive that it can be leveraged coercively even in less intimate relationships, like those made at work or school. The apparatus of border enforcement diffuses, and for the ethnic cleansing of racialized women and children, a functioning limb of the border enforcement agent can be found abruptly reaching out from the torso of a landlord, a teacher, a social worker, a partner, can be felt curling around them in family court or eviction court, every legal contact threatening to be the one that snaps tight and snares. In a society structured around the supremacy of adults and the total subjugation of children, their vulnerability to state violence and their location as its primary targets cannot be overstated. It is this marginalization that allows border enforcement to use them as bargaining chips, blackmail, and hostages. Little Liam Conejo Ramos, only 5 years old, was used as bait against his mother, prodded by agents to ring her front door, and then sent to the concentration camp in Dilley, Texas, where he became rapidly ill from the fetid water and rotten food served to him. Liam was the fourth child in the Columbia Heights Public Schools district in Minneapolis to be kidnapped by federal agents, among them two 17-year-olds and a 10-year-old abducted on her way to school. Federal agents have lurked near bus stops and have had to be chased from school parking lots. In the first year of the second Trump administration, border enforcement has kidnapped at least 3,800 children under the age of 18, including 20 infants. More than 1,300 have been kept incarcerated over the 20-day maximum limit mandated by the Flores settlement. A majority of the children detained by ICE in 2025 were eventually deported. Infants, toddlers, kids, teenagers, ICE kidnaps them all without hesitation and with a family member if they can. An adult who may sustain abuses to their own bodies for longer in the hopes of legal aid and escape from deportation will have a more difficult time holding out if they also have to watch a child they love suffer and wither. This is the operating logic of family detention. This, too, exists in historical continuity with border enforcement operations of the past. Every policing and border enforcement entity in the history of the United States has engaged in ritual abuses of racially marginalized children and used them as leverage against their loved ones. The fate of marginalized children, whether they will be erased via massacre, displacement, neglect, or indoctrination, has been among the primary concerns of every ethnic cleansing campaign. Using children in the way federal agents used Liam Ramos against his family members has always been common practice. In the 1970s, quote, Border Patrol agents also used the children of migrants either as bait or as a pressure tactic to force confessions. When coming upon a family, agents usually tried to apprehend the youngest member first, with the idea that relatives would give themselves up so as not to be separated. When a third of the ethnic Mexican population in the United States was forcibly expelled from the country during the Great Depression, a majority of the victims deported were children. Chiarchy is what connects all these systems of oppression and their every expression, the value system of authoritarianism and the practices that make it a social reality, powerful among them those that constitute white supremacy and patriarchy. The systems that interlock in such a way to make prisons, border, police, and military force possible, able to cohere into a material fact that debilitates and kills. That which sorts human lives into a hierarchy which enriches a shrinking center by dining on the ever-widening margins. It assigns value to or strips it from human lives through constructs of gender, race, ability, citizenship status, and more. All of which have meanings that are easily subject to change when advantageous to privileged castes. While administered and resourced by the mechanisms of state power, its values proliferate throughout all social relations in the hierarchy, protecting itself by handing out different stakes in its success. By these means, it can generally depend on people throughout the hierarchy to prioritize their own positions, some with aspirations to rise in the hierarchy and many others only desperate not to fall further below, and thus become collaborators in this larger system's maintenance. White people are called upon to defend white supremacy, to fill the ranks required to launch new ethnic cleansing campaigns, to defend the property accumulated through centuries of imperialism, enslavement, and genocide. Men dutifully volunteer to the service of patriarchy and drape themselves in its honors every time women, as a social group or as individuals in their personal lives, seem to be transcending the roles men designed for them. Adults render children into property to be leveraged and a commodity to be exchanged. People of all social positions and identities are subjected to extensive propaganda that incentivizes them to see their interests, their visions of success, their very sense of self, tied to the pursuit of power and control.